So, good evening, everyone. Thank you for having me here. It's a bit of a short notice, but I'm here. Before I start into the topic proper, I just want to say a few things, which is my gratitude to the Triple Gems, the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha for all these wonderful teachings that we are able to... Powerful statement. So,
paranormal activity.
So still my gratitude to the Triple Gems for the teachings that is of benefit to our lives, really. And also, I also want to just pay my respects to people in the audience who are actually more well-practiced than me, as I'm also just also learning about the Dhamma, and I have this opportunity to share, I guess, what I found out with everyone present. I got this phone call on... Was it Monday, Tuesday, about this original speaker who can't make it? And so I was asked to see if I could present a topic on Buddhism. And I thought, oh goodness, what am I going to talk about? And as Tas has mentioned, my profession is I'm a medical doctor. So I was like, okay, maybe I can talk about health. I don't need to think too much about that. Just always thought it's quite fascinating how we can always link Buddhism to most aspects of our lives, because I think Buddhism really is a part of our lives, really. Every day, every moment, everything that we do, you know, the Buddha does talk a lot about things that's very much daily life. And so the illusion of permanent health, interesting, because I think really to talk about this topic, the question really is, what is health? What do you consider health? I suppose we could always open up a dictionary and find out the meaning of health, but I mean, what do you guys think what health means to you? Yeah, audience participation is usually minimal. I don't know. Tas?
Sorry, I will get this.
Health. Yeah, I mean, what's the first thing that comes to your mind when we say health?
Not sick?
We said health is the greatest treasure.
Health is the greatest treasure? Yeah. Anything else?
State of physical and mental well-being. Mm.
Very typical medical student answer. I guess what I'm trying to really bring at is, I actually find health is quite subjective. I mean, just among the audience here, we already have sort of three different interpretations of health, right? It's the greatest treasure, state of physical and mental well-being, not being sick. And I guess really it's all of them combined, and it really is, from my personal perspective, really is sort of a combination of, you know, the biochemical things going on with how you are as a person. And also, I think there's a bit of a social expectation of what health is. So I think health is rather subjective, because there's also different levels of what we call norm. What is healthy to you? What is healthy to the other person? You know, to you and I, maybe having three meals a day, you know, like low-fat food, low salt, no deep-fried stuff, that's healthy. But whereas in another place where, you know, food is hard to come by, really anything they can get their hands on is food. It's healthy food. It's because compared to nothing, it's probably something, right? So, I mean, to start with, health is, I think it's already quite subjective. And furthermore, everybody is born differently, right? I mean, male, female, long hair, short hair, big build, small build, tall, short, blah, 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 blah. So, if everybody's standard is different, how do you say someone is absolutely healthy or perfectly healthy compared to someone who is, you know, say, not as healthy? And I guess we're lucky in the sense that we're all born with our faculties intact, you know, eye, ear, nose, tongue, touch, and of sound mind. I mean, I guess in my profession, I'm exposed to different people, and some of them have got really weird illnesses that I'm like, whoa, maybe you can write a case report about that, man. Get it published, make a name for myself. No, I'm too lazy to do that. But, you know, you know, there's a mixture of all these sort of illnesses that, and to be honest, medical students, you will know if you open your textbook, right, the longer the description is of that disease, the less we actually know about the disease, right? Because if I say you have this one, you know, if I say you have this illness, you're like, ah, okay, I know. But if we don't know what this illness is, then we go and describe the illness. Like, oh, this illness, there's long nose, long hair, funny tongue, and this illness. So we're like, okay. So it goes to show that actually, modern science, we haven't been able to classify every single illness, and as we continue to evolve, I don't think we'll ever be able to get a hold of every single illness possible. Medical students agree? So far, so good. Okay. And I think the other thing about health also is you probably hear a lot about the environment versus the inborn characteristics. You know, you're born a certain way, but depending on the environment you're in, you could be exposed to different things, and therefore that shapes how you are. And as an example, what you eat, what you grow up eat, what you grow up with. You know, for example, a lot of Asians eat rice and porridge growing up, right? So until this day, if I bring my parents to Australia, one day of pizza and salads, they're like, I need rice. Okay, so the rest of the trip, you know, it's going to be Chinese food, you know, Thai food, stir fry. It has to be rice. Is rice an essential part of health and diet? Probably for them. But, you know, we see local Australians or people from so-called Western countries, they grow up eating, I don't know, cereal. It's not rice. And, you know, so you can see that it's very different context, but, you know, they're not anywhere less healthy than, you know, it's a different, so it's also this huge environment that shapes our health. And what I find very annoying is also what is the latest health food, right? It's almost what is created by marketing. You know, I don't know if you go to Coles, if you go to those organic shops, whatever is your eye level counter shelves, right? That's your latest health food. Okay, and at the moment I think it's all about coconuts. Coconut oil, coconut cream, coconut in your facial, coconut in your chai latte. But I mean, when I was growing up, coconut was the bad thing. It increases your cholesterol. It's the thing that, you know, poor people eat, you know, things like that. I'm like, I never heard about coconut being a health food when I was growing up. And suddenly now it's sort of, ooh, you must have coconut. And then, you know, what do I do in my free time? Look at Facebook. And they say, the 5 superfoods you must have. I'm like, coconut. So, So I think that's why health is very, health and healthy food is sometimes quite subjective. Now, sure, if someone's genuinely lacking in a certain type of nutrient and they encounter this certain type of foods, it matches what they lack, then, you know, of course, it serves them well. But in everything in moderation, if you eat a balanced diet, things like that, then you don't particularly need this super coconut health food. So environment plays a huge factor in things. And there's also the aspect of our mental health, which is not often talked about, because when we think about health, I think a lot of people automatically think about our physical health, right? I have a cold, I'm not healthy, things like that. But also a huge sense of how our mental health is, in that how we actually respond to our environment, stress, anxiety. I mean, it's almost exam time, right?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay. So we see less smiles, we see frowns, and the eyebrows start to come together. So, you know, are you sick? You know, I check your blood pressure, I check your temperature, you're probably fine. But are you, you know, calm and happy? I don't know, only you can tell. Depends how much you prepare for exams. Yeah, so, I mean, these last 5-10 minutes, I've only just been talking about what my interpretation of health is. Does that make sense to people? Is that what you agree or disagree with so far with regards to health? You know, generally speaking, broadly speaking. Yeah. Because I think another part of branch out from health is beauty, right? And again, I think this can be extremely subjective. They say what? Beauty is in the eye of the beholder, isn't it? You know, if your boyfriend or if that person's your boyfriend or girlfriend, doesn't matter whether they have makeup or no makeup, their hair is messy or whatever, they're still the most beautiful and handsome person to you. Right? And you know, the so-called standard of beauty also changes with times. I mean, some of you may know my other interest is in photography. So, you know, when I see what people say is a beautiful photo or a beautiful model, and I'm like, really? But just looking through all the photography magazines and fashion magazines and things like that, you know, 50, 60 years ago, the standard of beauty is the person's usually a bit more plump. You know, it's not the skinny look. The skin is not altogether flawless, like cannot have one little pimple or one little scratch or one little freckle there. But these are standards of beauty, and I think in a lot of ways this is quite artificial and man-made, right? If everybody says that's beautiful, that will be beautiful, right? Even if that one person disagree. And I mean, a closer example to, I think, friends here would be, I don't know what cartoons or things you grew up with, what, you know, what sort of MTV or things you grew up with. But, you know, I think when I was in the process of growing up, the in thing was Japanese pop, right? But nowadays it's K-pop. And some of my younger cousins and siblings kind of, you know, the fashion standard that they look up to is those boys who look like girls. Okay, all the Korean stars that hardly look like a man. So I'm like, okay, but this is a beauty standard, you know what I mean? And the way we have our haircuts, our makeup, that's also largely shaped by what society and what you and your friends feel is beautiful, right? I mean, I think when my father was growing up, he said he would go to the barber and he would bring up the Beatles magazine, right, and say, give me a haircut like that, but end up everyone's the same, 3-2-1, go out of the barber shop, $5, thank you. But but I mean, if I ask any of you to cut a Beatles hairstyle today, you'll be like, my gosh, that is so retro. So, you know, beauty really is quite subjective. You know, if you take, you know, someone who is beautiful as part of being a healthy person, then again, this is also quite subjective, right? So, but really, I think whenever we talk about health, right, I always like to talk about the unavoidable things in life, which is taxes and death. All right? I mean, tax, you can kind of evade tax, but it's illegal, huh? But old age, sickness, and death is something that's truly unavoidable. You agree? Yeah? And, you know, what industry in medicine earns the most money is probably cosmetics and plastics. All right? I have a friend who was in the same year of medical school as me. He went back to Malaysia. And he was telling me about how his friends went to specialize in non-invasive cosmetic surgery. Okay? So, you know, you want your mole removed? Okay, psst, gone. Okay? And you want, you know, Botox, whatever, like, you know, mine very minimally invasive things, okay? And the equipment they bought from the US or wherever was like couple of tens of thousands of dollars, you know, a few machines. Within 3 months, they got back all of their expenses and started to make profit. Okay? 3 months. Okay? Whereas if you ask a local GP in Singapore, Malaysia, Indonesia, or even in Australia, I don't think you can even recuperate that amount in that amount of time. So it goes to show how much human beings, us, normally treasure beauty and health. And I heard that each package that they sell is in a couple of thousand dollars. You know, it's not like, you know, so, and you think about, you go see your GP, it's that, oh, $50 consultation, no, this is like a few thousand dollars for one session. I'm like, wow, I should have done that. But really, why do people seek this? Because the body does break down. I mean, if you were eternally youthful, if you always have tight skin, no wrinkles, no grey hair, you don't need this. Well, people don't need to crave for this if they have it. But because the body does change, right? It is impermanent. It, you know. And to really drill home this point, I sort of want to just talk about the human body a little bit. A, because it's my profession, it's easy for me to talk about. And B, it's actually very relevant to learning and appreciating Buddhist teachings. Because, I mean, most of you here are young. You know, you've probably, I don't know how old you are, but you'll probably be between 18 to 30, 35, something like that. Okay, that's considered young, youthful, teenage, whatever, but you're young, okay? And from a physical perspective, you are probably at the peak of your time in your life. You know, the body is starting to mature or hasn't fully matured yet. For those of you who are still trying to get your bone health and get a bit taller, I think for boys, it stops at 21. For girls, because puberty was earlier, if you're, I think, 20 or latest, you'll be 21, but by 21, you'll definitely be over that. So, you know. But still, you're young, considered. But you've only just got a fully matured body. And you know how those emotional swings you had when you were a teenager? that seems to be settling down, and you know, you sort of seem to have a bit more of a stable personality and things like that. That's also probably because your brain actually undergoes a lot of change from when you were a baby to a child to a teenager, and now that you're a young adult. So physiologically, you know, those things have sort of reached a stable point. And you're at this stage where, without needing to exercise very hard or watch what you eat, you don't really gain weight. And you feel like you can run for a very long time and play sports without feeling very tired. Whereas if you ask someone like me, and I'm not even that old, right? But if I eat McDonald's for 5 days in a row, my tummy will come out, which is pretty ugly, okay? But you're at this stage in your life where you don't quite feel that illness is a bother. You get a cold and probably within a week you'll be up running again. You can burn the midnight oil and within 2 days you'll be up on your feet attending lectures, no problems, you're not dozing off. For me, if I do one night shift, I need about 4 days to recuperate. So, but really to drive home this message that if you contemplate on your body, right, every moment this body is different. It is breaking down and rebuilding itself, breaking down and rebuilding itself every moment. And for someone who gets older and older in their life, it breaks down 10% but rebuilds maybe 9%. So you, every moment you lose a little bit, kind of there. But if I just bring your attention to your own body for the moment, right? Have you ever paid attention to your own breathing? Yeah? Do you need to control yourself to breathe? Well, if you do, then you'll probably be dead at nighttime, right? When you go to sleep. So there's a lot of processes that you don't think about and you don't actually have full control of. Yeah? Another example is when you get hungry and you want to eat. I mean, if you're going on a retreat where there's minimal food, if you truly can control, you probably eat everything today, and then you tell your body, today I just want to digest 10%. Tomorrow I want to digest 20%. So then the whole week, I don't need to eat. But you can't, right? You can't, right? You can't say you eat for your breakfast tomorrow, tonight. You just can't. It just doesn't work that way, okay? And do we have a choice or can we control that? Not really. This is the human body. We are born with it. And, you know, we are shaped by whatever you want to call it, DNA, karma. But this is what we have at the moment. And this is what we have to work with. So we often have this illusion of control, that we can control our body. There are some things that we can initiate and control with our current physical state. But that control, if you break it down, is dependent on a lot of factors. Okay? So I'll just give you an example again. if you want to just have a drink, right? Move your cup, have a drink, right? I need to have a signal somewhere in my body to tell me I'm thirsty. All right. If you're not thirsty, or if you don't feel like, you know, you just don't feel like you need to get a drink. And then that impulse needs to be sent to your brain. And then your brain kind of says, need water, need fluids. Okay. And then somewhere in there, you know, it needs to send a signal to that goes down your spinal cord, then to your arms, twitch your muscles, then move your arm to the cup. And then it needs to send a signal to move it, blah, 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 and come here. So if at any point of this stage there's a breakdown in communication, it just doesn't work. Right? So you get what I'm saying? Like, we think we have control on all these things, but really, I don't think we have genuine control of it. stroke patients, you know, part of that circuit gets blocked off and they just can't. The arm is there, the muscle is there, but the signal's not getting through. So if we have control, I'll be able to tell the body to say, okay, can you just repair this circuit? Okay, then I can move my arm. And if that's the case, I suppose we don't need to have rehab after stroke, right? That's fine. You just tell your brain to repair everything. You'll be fine. Go home, you know. Or even when you get a cough or a cold, like, just tell your body, okay, the virus is here. Go kill the virus. Get back to work tomorrow. But yeah, we're like, oh, I gotta go. I wanna go to school. I wanna go to uni. Can I get a medical certificate? So just within, you know, our body, I'm just trying to say that we think we have control on all these things, but we probably don't have full control. We probably have some control, but I don't think we ever have full control. Yeah? And furthermore, the body is also body and life, our life, is dependent, co-dependent on a lot of other factors. We need air, oxygen, okay? And that's very fundamental. Like, if the medical students here, you probably be able to know how we extract air, oxygen from the air into our body. It's actually quite fascinating because if you think about it, our body is kind of a solid mass and water-filled mass, right? But yet we must be able to get this air into our body. Like, how, you know, when we use humidifiers or dehumidifiers, we extract the moisture from the air, condense, blah, 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 then come out water. We're like, air, just all we do is breathe, right? And then food, you know, we need to eat. We need nutrients, we need, you know, carbohydrates, proteins, whatever you have it. We need all these things and we're dependent on them. And I think in recent years, the medical field or the biology field sort of is increasingly recognizing that our health, our mental state even, is quite dependent on the bacteria in us. So to give you to really drive that point, right, do you know that the total amount of bacteria in you is more than your total number of cells that is actually you? Surprising? Yeah. So, and it's really like a jungle in there, because everything is in a state of equilibrium. And from a medical perspective, really, we know that sometimes if we upset that equilibrium, you actually get more sick. Sometimes if we give some people antibiotics, it upsets their balance in their gut, such that some usual bacteria in there that, you know, is suppressed by this other bacteria is suddenly able to grow. You know what I'm talking about, right, medical students? Okay, good. So, I mean, it's like the law of the jungle. You know, you remove the wolves from this jungle, the deer start coming out, they start eating vegetation that is all over the place, the vegetation gets lost, it affects the soil erosion, the river changes the path, so on and so forth. It's pretty similar. And so, without us actually knowing, our body is quite dependent on this bacteria as well. So not just are we not in full control of our body, we are very codependent on a lot of other factors, right? So really, you know, I think the Buddhist practice of contemplation of the body is actually very important. And I think in a lot of places, one of the first few practices the monks do when they ordain is actually to contemplate on the loathsomeness of the body. You know, they collect their hair, they collect the nails, these are. Why? Because this really is, you know, when it was on you, it was a beautiful nail. Now that they cut it off, it's like, ee, throw away. But this was part of your body before you cut it off. Right? So the body is truly impermanent. Right? And but understanding this, though, I really like the fact that if you understand the body as it is, then I think we'd be able to break down a lot of barriers between people, you know? Because if you look at person to person on a bodily level, there really is not much difference between you and I. Sure, I know I talked about DNA and sort of some people are tall and short, but really, we all suffer the same problem of the impermanence of the body, right? Like, for example, you know, in the when we bring someone into the operating theater for an operation, you cut them open, they all look the same. It doesn't matter whether you're male, well, okay, if you're male or female, of course, there's differences there. But sort of the rest of the parts are the same, you know, you're still made of bone, blood, fat. You know, your intestines are still the same. Like, so why would this person be more prestigious or more, you know, or, you know, why would there be a need to show particular favoritism or discrimination between this person and that person? Because really, we're the same thing. Well, similar. So I find that whenever I have some disgust or hatred towards a certain person, just thinking about this makes me go, oh yeah, actually, you know, we're still humans, fundamentally, and we still suffer the same issues of greed, hatred, delusion. So there really is no need for me to be angry or disgust with this person because, like me, that person has the same afflictions. You know, I mean, that works for me because just for me, contemplating the body itself brings me to the level of we're all humans, right? Doesn't matter where you're, whether you're, you know, you're black, white, Chinese, Malay, Indian, whatever, you know, we're the same, we're humans. And that gives a lot of grounding for how we are as humans. Yeah? And again, just like our physical health, our thoughts are sometimes uncontrollable. It takes a lot of practice to actually tame the mind. I think you probably all share some of that similar experience when you try to do meditation. You know, the moment I say, close your eyes, take in a deep breath, what did I have? What am I going to have for dinner afterwards? I go to enlightenment, I'll order fries, I'll order stir fry. No, big breath, deep, McDonald's, french fries, deep. Tonight I'm going to play Dota 2. Deep. So, I mean, if we had real control of our mind, the moment if we want to concentrate and practice meditation, it shouldn't be a problem, right? But yet we can. And it takes a lot of practice, both in your in our meditation as well as our daily life to maintain that, to be able to achieve that. I mean, as a lay person, you and I, who's not the best practiced, you know, I often find that thoughts are quite difficult to control, and sometimes thoughts are so bad that they get uncontrollable that they cause illness, including physical illness. You know, some people are really very depressed, they're really very anxious, that it really affects their life. And if you think about it, they don't always have a physical illness that causes that. Like, this person's blood test, scans, whatever, is all going to be normal. But yet they have this uncontrollable urge and difficulty coping with their lives because they're too anxious, they're too worried, they're too upset, things like that. And you know, I think we should be thankful and grateful that we are not in that position, and we can function reasonably normally and continue to go on with our lives and practice the Buddhist teachings. So what does all these mean for us? So if it's so uncontrollable and so, you know, doomed to fail and things like that, what can we actually do? I think I probably talked about the illusion of permanent health, haven't I? Yeah? It's not quite permanent. It's the truth of impermanent life, impermanent health now. Any questions so far? Have I lost anyone? Any disagreements with what I've said? Or complaints? Lost? Silence. Okay. So then, as a as a Buddhist, then I thought, okay, so the Buddha is the wise one. What has he mentioned in the past with relation to all these? I mean, surely there must be a way out. He is, after all, the enlightened one. If he doesn't quite have the answers, then I think I'm pretty much screwed, am I not? So, I think understanding that we have impermanence of body and impermanence of our mind itself, I think there's a few aspects to then understanding that. Because, I mean, what's the Four Noble Truths? I mean, by now a few of you should be able to tell me what's Four Noble Truths, right? Dum dum dum. What's the first truth?
About dukkha.
Yeah. Yeah. I often think that that's actually very important. You know, it's often, whenever we say about Four Noble Truths, right, we usually go, it's suffering, end of suffering, suffering, cause of suffering, end of suffering, path to end suffering, full stop. But I actually think that if we truly appreciate the first truth itself, it actually shifts our perspective into the right frame. Because after all, if you don't have a problem, there doesn't need to be a solution, right? You know what I mean? Like, if you have no problems with, I don't know, math, for example, there's no need for you to go and revise and practice math like 10 times a day, right? I see Alina smiling. You know what I mean? So, if you don't recognize that there is a problem, then you're not looking for a solution to end the problem. Yeah? That's why I always appreciate coming back to the first truth, because then we know that there is a problem. And this problem is that we want things to be permanent, but we have A, no control, and B, it's truly impermanent. Right? Then if we recognize that problem to start with, then at least we can start addressing that problem. You agree? Yeah? I mean, I often come across patients who say, "Doctor, why am I sick?" I'm like, "I don't know, because it's nature." You know what I mean? Like, sometimes, sure, there are some, if you do silly things, or sometimes it's not even what you can control. It just, some things just happen. We can explain some things, and some things genuinely we can't. Like, why does this person who smokes like 2 packets of cigarettes a day for the last 40 years of their life don't have cancer, and that person who exercises 3 times a day, eats fruits and vegetables, and goes exercise and doesn't touch a cigarette in life have lung cancer? I cannot explain. Is it their genes? No? No family history of that? Have they been exposed to some weird stuff? Don't know. Have they been bitten by a radioactive spider? Then how come they didn't become Spider-Man? I don't know. There's some things that we can explain, and there's some things we genuinely can't. Yeah?
You say you don't know why, but there's a lot of Buddhists that think they do know why.
Hmm.
I think that it's some sort of karmic thing, in some really sort of vague way that they won't give any evidence for.
Suddenly
the wheelchair has done something nasty and it's really good life.
Yeah, I take that point. And I generally try to avoid that point.
Oh, yes.
Only because it opens up a huge can of worms. Because, I mean, first of all, I'm a lay practitioner, and I must admit I don't have that high level of meditation of supernatural powers to see what's previous actions, what the karmic karmic effects are, and things like that. So I can only speak from what I can see, which is what I see in my line of work as people who have diseases and things like that. I think there are some Buddhist practitioners who believe that there are certain past bad things they've done that resulted in bad karma that then resulted in this. And I honestly don't know, because I can't prove nor disprove that.
In the grace of the arrogance.
Sorry?
Is there a little bit arrogant for these people to actually say this? I'm almost blaming people. Like, I mean, in England a while ago, we had a football manager for some reason that was into this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
What's his name? Hoddle.
Mm-hmm.
He said people in wheelchairs deserve it because they did something in previous life.
Yeah.
Luckily, he was immediately sacked. But, you know.
Yeah. Well, I think that's probably a bit of an unfair statement. I mean, the general...
This guy was Christian, by the way.
But, you know, in general, sort of from a Buddhist perspective, if you see someone who is suffering at the moment, who is already in a wheelchair, whatever, if it's truly karmic effects, that person's reaping it now. If it's not karmic effects, that person's still in the wheelchair now. This person probably needs help, assistance, and it's probably the compassionate thing to do to assist them. Talking about those things will be quite academic, and really doesn't change this person's life in the future. But going back to that point of whether people have diseases and things because of their previous karmic acts, probably, but we just can't prove it scientifically yet.
It could be just they were in the wrong place at the wrong time, of course.
Could be.
I mean, it's still cause and effect, isn't it?
Yeah, but... You know, there are millions of things in the environment, plus changes in our body, that it's just almost impossible to pinpoint.
You don't get hit by a bus because you don't look properly, not because of something happening.
Yeah. I'm talking about some other more obscure things, you know, like, you know, say for example, this person's got cancer. They've been a, you know, so-called a healthy person their whole life. Like I said, they eat well, they exercise well, etc., but they still have cancer. Like, we just... Why? Who knows?
But there are genes, aren't there, that make you more susceptible?
Yeah, but why is it that it happens to this person at this time when there's no other family history of blah, 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 blah? We blame it on mutation, blame it on this, blame it on that. Sure, there probably are some biochemical things, but why this person, don't know. But the fact is still that this person's got cancer now. So coming back to this, that we have no genuine control of our body, our mind, so what do we do? I said that I look to the Buddha for some answers, and appreciating the first truth and understanding that we have an impermanent body, and that we cling on to a permanent self. So then I think there is this thing about us considering ourselves as a patient who is sick from our body and mind, physical illness, as well as our idea we suffer because we would like our body to be permanent, but we are not permanent. So therefore, every changing moment and every new wrinkle and every grey hair causes huge distress. Yeah? So that's something, broadly speaking, is in the Buddhist text, I came across this, that a sick person has five qualities that make him hard to tend to. He does not know the proper amount in things amenable to his cure. He does not take his medicine. He does not tell his symptom as they actually present, such as saying they are worse when they are worse, and they are improving when they are improving, or remaining the same when remaining the same. And he's not the type who can endure bodily feelings that are painful, fierce, sharp, rattling, repellent, disagreeable, life-threatening. That's 4 points. I must have had a typo. But yeah, I think, although these things, I think when the Buddha, or in the suttas when this was mentioned, it would probably refers to something that's more physical. But if we look at this, they can be applied to our mental health as well, isn't it? He does not know the proper amount in things available to his cure. I mean, and he does not take his medicine. I mean, medicine really, I'll just go on to read on a few more things. So this is Mahakasapa, who is one of the chief disciples of the Buddha when he was sick. Of course, I summarized the whole thing, but this was from one of the scriptures, the suttas. The Buddha asked Mahakasapa, he said, "I hope you are getting better, comfortable, that your pains are lessening and not increasing, and not of their increasing." And then Mahakasapa said, "None of the above." So, you know, I'm not getting better, I'm not more comfortable, my pains are getting worse, they are increasing. So then the Buddha said, "These 7 factors for awakening rightly taught by me, when developed and pursued, lead to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, to unbinding. Which 7? That is mindfulness, analysis, persistence, rapture, serenity, concentration and equanimity." And then, as the sutta says, Mahakasapa, delighted by his words, recovered from illness. Maybe I should use this for all my patients. Huh? But I guess, you know, reading from this, right, for someone who is quite well trained in the Buddhist teachings, really the body is a bit more irrelevant to him. It's really the mental state that really relieves him of his suffering. I mean, if anyone truly is able to practice the 7 factors of enlightenment rightly taught by the Buddha, then I think that we can experience joy and happiness, calmness and peace in whatever kind of state of our physical condition. Because really, what does the Buddha teach about us as people is we are made of aggregates, isn't it? We're body and mind, it's consciousness, perception, feelings. It's codependent, it's interdependent on each other. So there's no true I or self. And to illustrate this point again, as this teaching in this Nakula Pitta Sutta. Nakula Pitta is a person, just so you know. And he's a householder, meaning he's a layperson like you and I. Okay? And so he went to the Buddha and said, "Lord, I am a feeble old man, aged, advanced in years, having come to the last stage of life. I am afflicted in body and ailing with every moment." Pretty much what I described, right? Then the Buddha said, "Oh, so it is, householder, so it is. The body is afflicted, it's weak and encumbered. For who, looking after this body, would claim even a moment of true health except through sheer foolishness? So you should train yourself. Even though I may be afflicted in body, my mind will be unafflicted. That is how you should train yourself. So I think in this part of the paragraph, it's quite clear that the Buddha is suggesting, even to us householders. Because as you may know, some of the teachings that the Buddha teaches is applicable to more so to monastics, and some are a bit more applicable to lay people like you and I. This is towards the lay person, which is quite applicable to you and I. As I said, you know, even though you may be afflicted in body, you should train yourself such that your mind is unafflicted, right? And then he didn't ask the Buddha how to train his mind. So he walked away, and then luckily he had Sariputta, who is another chief disciple of the Buddha. So lucky for him, he didn't miss the Buddha and didn't get an answer. He still got an answer. So then was then asked by... Sariputta then actually asked him, in what way is one afflicted in body and in mind? And in what way is one afflicted in body but unafflicted in mind? Okay, Sariputta followed and answered that the uninstructed person with no regard for noble ones is not well versed or disciplined in their Dhamma, who has no regard for men of integrity, is not well versed or disciplined in their Dhamma. And he basically goes on to say that assumes form to be the self. Form to be the self, as in the physical form, to be a permanent self. You know, or the self as possessing form, as in an entity actually having a bodily form, like owning the form. Then he sees with the idea that I am form, or form is mine. Okay, as he is seized with these ideas, his form changes and alters, and he falls into sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair over this change and alteration. So, is that clear, or do you want me to repeat that? Do you want me to read that again? Have I gone too fast?
I think repeat.
Okay. So, in summary, so the uninstructed person, in essence, is seized, or has that idea that I am form. Permanent me is form. Me equals this body. Or me equals mind. Body, mind. Okay? Permanent I. Okay? As he sees with these ideas, as if he holds on to this idea, as the form changes, he then falls into sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair over its change and alteration. So, I mean, this last bit is pretty a standard extension of most of the things he talked about. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, despair. Sorrow, lamentation, blah, blah, blah. Okay. But it's if we hold on to the idea that body is permanent, is me, or mind is permanent, is me, then as these things change, then we have a problem and we suffer. Make sense? Lost, confused, wants to fall asleep. Okay. So, and he goes on to elaborate that apart from the form, holds on to feeling, perception, mental fabrications, and consciousness. Again, these are the things that the Buddha talks about as the five aggregates. Okay. So I think with these two things, it's quite clear to us that, you know, the body does change. And if the body changes, we are upset. We go into pain, sorrow, lamentation, despair. Pain, sorrow, lamentation, despair. And his example to Venerable Mahakasapa was that, you know, if you practice these seven factors of enlightenment rightly, then you are delighted by the words, recover from illness. And he instructs, the Buddha instructs his monks, again in part of the sutta, that when one is focused on the unattractiveness with regard to the body. So now he's teaching us on how to to shift the attention rightly towards our body. Unattractiveness with regard to the body. Percipient of foulness with regard to food. So, we get very attached to food, right? What's the first thing when you order your wonderful cappuccino or latte from the cafe on Saturday morning and it comes to your table? Correct. Correct. Instead of smelling it, looking at it, you... Excellent cafe, hashtag don't know what, don't know what, don't know what. Right? Like we are engrossed with our food and then we get our food to say cheese, click. You know? How many of the photos in your Facebook is about food? Hashtag best breakfast, whatever, hashtag I don't know what, I don't even use hashtag, I don't even know how it works. But you know, we get so engrossed with our food, right? And you know, and then I like this saying that, do you eat to survive or do you survive to eat? Which one are you? Huh? I don't know, that's up to you. So I mean the Buddha does teach, or you know, that with regard to food, right, it's medicine to sustain this body. It's simple as that, right? Have you ever been hungry? You have, right? And at that point, right, do you still pick and choose your food? Or do you just say, I just want to eat something so I don't feel this hunger in my, you know, this discomfort, this growling, this pain that you have in your tummy? Do you go to, I need to go all the way to Wollongong to find that vegetarian restaurant selling don't know what so that I can eat and be satisfied? Or you kind of just go, I just want to go to the nearest cafe or whatever, buy a sandwich or whatever and just eat. The first one or the second one, if you're genuinely hungry? The second one, right? Okay. If you say the first one, then I think you're actually not that hungry. Okay? But, you know, the Buddha does teach us to... He mentioned this percipient of foulness with regard to food. Not that you dislike your food, but really to be a bit more detached in the sense that you see food... Not seafood, huh? You look at food as it is. It's food to sustain your body, okay? You don't leave here and go, I want a fish, crab, prawn, because Mingde just now says seafood. No. You look at food and regard food as just food, as medicine to cure our this illness of hunger, this discomfort of hunger. And precipitant of undesirability of all fabrications, which really is your thoughts, your feelings. You know, I think this is quite important because we often get very attached to good, pleasant feeling. Yeah, we do what we like because it makes us feel good, and we want more of it. Okay. I guess in the general, you know, the general world per se, a lot of it comes down to drug and alcohol, isn't it? Like, why do people, I mean, honestly, drugs and alcohol are expensive, right? Like, but people go for it and keep going back to it. Why? Because, okay, there are biochemical changes to your brain, etc., but it makes them feel high, it makes them feel good. But is there anything... You know, what is it that makes them feel good? It's a feeling, you know. It's a feeling of euphoria, warmth, whatever you want to call it, but it's a good feeling. And to a certain extent, we all experience it, right? We still like our warm bed because, you know, we feel warm. It's uncomfortable to feel cold. We still like tasty food, you know, because, well, it makes us feel happy. And when you're all preparing for exams and feeling very stressed, your favorite foods are probably potato chips, French fries, pizza, you know, all the oily, salty stuff. That actually has got an evolutionary purpose, by the way. Because when back in the days when we were all cavemen, food is hard to come by, right? And so high energy foods are really hard to come by. And if you think about it, we in this day, you know, where do you get your salt? Where do you get salt? Coles, Woolies, supermarket. When if you're a caveman, where are you going to get salt? Don't know. So I mean, evolutionary, with humans generally develop a taste for these sort of things. That's why, you know, in this day and age, when we feel stressed, right? Although we don't have so much physical stress, but we have mental stress, exams, relationships, blah blah blah. So then, you know, just if you don't believe me, just try it out. Okay, when you're stressed, 12 a.m. the night before exams, if you're hungry, you tell me what you most feel like having. If you're, I can almost be certain that your top three choices are chocolate, chips, and I don't know, something salty or fatty. Maccas, right? There are instant noodles. Why? High salt, high fat again, okay? Who here eats Indomie? See what I mean? See what I mean? I have proven my point, okay. But anyways, I digressed a bit, but it all comes back to this feeling, feel good, you know? We want more of it. For some people, it's shopping. It gives us a sense of satisfaction to buy stuff. Play games, I don't know what games. Now, board games, right? Nowadays, board games, bang, or don't know what it is now. But, you know, you like that feeling and you want more of it. Such that, and if it goes to extremes, then you get into trouble because you neglect other aspects of your life. But if we learn to, first of all, enable to identify that it's this feeling that you keep wanting to come back to, then at least you have a bit of an opportunity to address it as, okay, this is a pleasant feeling. It's come when we were doing X, Y, and Z, and now it's gone because, you know, the event is over. Time to just go back to reality. And one other thing that the Buddha said is the perception of death well established. Sounds a bit gruesome, right? But as I've said before, you know, many of us don't actually think about death, right? And, you know, it's difficult to accept and it's difficult to practice. But if we are able to establish that, then we know that our life, our loved one's life, is limited. There is a time frame. We actually don't know when. And I think we actually develop a sense of appreciation, gratitude to ourselves and everyone around us. And that also gives a bit of an encouragement to try and practice the Dharma as much as possible with whatever given chance we have. Yeah. Actually, in one of the Mahayana chants, you know, one of the recollections in the evening chants is to address as if you were a fish out of water, or that your head is on fire, or something similar. Because if you're a fish out of water, you feel uncomfortable. You want to do something quickly to get back or to feel comfortable again. So if you're such, right, then you won't want to waste time doing useless things. You'll be spending your time wisely, practicing diligently. Okay. And I often think to myself that it's actually okay to be slow, but it's probably trouble if you stop practicing completely. An act of kindness is an act of non-self, generosity. An act of, you know, a moment to just contemplate on your breath. Even just one breath is one breath contemplation gain. you know, it's really nothing to lose. And so I think if that's as gruesome as this may sound, but this is reality, I think. Okay, now, any questions so far? Lost?
Oh, I'm not a guy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
You talk about impermanence.
Yeah.
Which seems very sensible, you know, we get sick and then we die. It's almost like part of Buddhism is accepting the world the way it is and rejecting delusion and ignorance. But then this thing about rebirth seems to sort of, it's almost like an ad hoc modification to a theory. You know, we accept all this and then we say, well, actually, that's not true.
Yeah.
There is something permanent. And this thing about body being impermanent, the mind, that transcends death, that's surely.
So,
I mean, I don't believe a word of it, you know, because it's contradictory and it seems to be delusional.
I think these topics are always rather controversial, depending on which particular school of Buddhism the person practices. But I always like to come back to what we have in the present moment. If we, you know, I like to think of rebirth as this moment or this current cycle of suffering, right? So the 12 links of dependent origination usually comes to mind when it comes to that. And it could be this moment creating this particular discomfort, and this moment is now gone. So that moment has gone. It's died in that sense, if you will. So this current cycle has finished and is resulted in suffering, and the next cycle has come. And so that's, I guess, in a sense, rebirth, if you will.
How long are these moments?
Could be any moment.
Or just a second.
Could be second, microseconds, yeah, however quick you're...
This is not what they mean. I think something transfers.
Yeah. So if you're talking particularly about that, again, I don't have any evidence for that.
Nobody has.
Yeah, precisely.
You try and find this evidence. Occasionally somebody says there is evidence, but you
don't
find it.
Yeah. So I stopped chasing that. I stopped looking into that because I think it doesn't help my personal practice, and sort of knowing that answer really doesn't change much in the daily practice or the relief of my suffering. It's probably an interesting academic exercise, but finding out that answer doesn't help me, at least my personal practice, whether it's relieving suffering or making any progress with my practice. So really, I stopped looking into that particular, for that particular answer.
So you don't believe it then?
Well, I leave it open.
But do you believe in green monkeys in the middle of Jupiter? I mean, there's lots of things we can make up.
Yeah.
We have no evidence for that.
Oh, look, I think that's one of the difficulties is, you know, whenever we look for a concrete answer that we would try to satisfy ourselves with, but if, you know, we just don't have enough evidence, or we just can't say yes or no. You know.
Can I ask you a follow-up question? As a doctor.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. We've had people here claim this. They can remember previous lives, and they also imply they could. Or actually, one bloke did claim they can remember future lives. Okay, but these are memories. Now, memories are stored in the brain, neural connections.
Yeah,
and you must have had patients who have had Alzheimer's and this other sort of. And you can see them deteriorate and can't remember things. So, do you agree that it's a physical thing, memories?
That's often from my knowledge at the moment, we don't actually fully understand how memories are formed.
That could be something
that's yeah Yeah, could be. Yeah, could be. We just don't know.
I thought that was pretty much.
Yeah.
Because of.
I mean, it's. And really, you know, I actually find there's no conflict between medicine and Buddhism, but we just, there's a lot of things that we can't explain yet with modern medicine as yet. For example, we still don't fully understand why we need to sleep. Without sleep, we die, yes, but we still don't know fully why we need to sleep. That's, you know, that's almost like a, you know, it's almost a given that we sleep and wake, but we still don't know why. We don't know how memories are formed, and we don't know what exactly makes us us. We, you know, we do MRIs and functional MRIs, PET scans, all these expensive scans. I mean, I don't know how much of it is genuine interest or how much of it is trying to get research credibility. Like, yeah, my name is on this paper, put me up there. But, you know, we still haven't found what is us in this brain. We still don't know. We just don't know. And so, you know, rebirth, memories, past lives, future lives. We can only take a best guess. And if it doesn't help with our Dharma practice, I usually just leave it alone. And, you know, as a matter of personal interest, if someone, if one day someone comes around with a, you know, a reliable means of measuring these things and proves me wrong, great, I'm very interested to hear it. But until then, I can neither prove it nor disprove it. So it's just like, okay, leave it there, and I'll just go back to my own practice of relieving myself of suffering. Sorry, I dwindle and I digress a bit, but you know, that's my general approach to these sort of questions that I have when I was, you know, looking for answers about learning the Dharma. Yeah, not always very satisfactory, but I find peace with myself in knowing that the answers to some of these things are quite irrelevant. And an analogy I quite like in quoted in from the what the Buddha taught is, the Buddha said to his group of disciples, he in front of them he picked up a bunch of leaves from the ground and he said, monks, of the bunch of leaves that I hold in my hand here compared to the forest behind, which is more? And then obviously the monk said, you know, Buddha, the forest behind you. And then he said, but of the things that I have taught you, right, I have taught you what is helpful and relevant to delivering you from your suffering, you know. And so it's like this bunch of leaves that I have in my hand, okay. It certainly is less than the forest behind, but these are the things that you need to know to be free from suffering. So, you know, I quite like that analogy, and it sort of gave me a bit of peace and ease of mind that, sure, there are probably thousands and millions of things in the world that we can or can't explain by signs, supernatural phenomena, what have you. But what the Buddha has taught is really the crux of, that's all knowledge, great, but these bunch of leaves are the things that I have taught you that will help you be free from suffering. That's the way I see things, and so far it's worked all right.
He also told us to avoid delusion, ignorance, and greed.
Yeah. But following this bunch of things that he's taught, I think we are quite safe from greed, hatred, and delusion.
I think my point is that you're wasting time talking about things that probably aren't true, we have no evidence for, is delusion.
Sorry, I'm lost.
No, I'll probably put that quite right. But if we've got no evidence for things,
yep,
there's no difference between notice and making something up. So should we waste our time?
No, go back to your Buddhist practice of, you know, the same things, five precepts, eightfold paths, those things. Those will deliver us from, you know, those from suffering.
Mm. No, I agree with that. The speaker last week, who's not coming from that, but... The
Chen Hong?
Yeah, he's talking about sort of core Buddhist. There's something Jim speaks about.
Yeah. I still fall back on that analogy of the bunch of leaves in the forest. Sure, there's lots of things that we can find out, but when I was in high school, I wanted to know how the universe worked. I went out to buy books on how the universe began, and then I got more and more confused. And I'm like, wow, there's this, you know, Big Bang, measurement of time, relativity, the singularity, you know, then this right conditions where entropy and what worked, then there's this medieval primordial soup that created complex carbohydrates. And I'm like, okay, then I put the book down, and then my mom just said, come, cook dinner, let's go eat. Like, okay, so whatever I have just read then is completely irrelevant to the current life that I have now. I still wake up, do my chores, I still have the same things of feeling hunger, tired, the same suffering that I'm not free of. So, you know, I still get interested in these topics every now and again, but I find that it's not relevant to my daily life. I try and be a good person, I try my best to follow the precepts, do my meditation practice, and if I have one moment of peace, then that's one moment of peace that I have achieved. And if I don't have moments of peace, then I work harder towards achieving that. Yeah.
Science is still quite interesting.
Hmm?
Science is interesting. I mean,
yeah.
Just because we have to practice, it's cool.
So.
Not it so much.
Yeah, that's right. So. So just coming back to the topic of illusion of permanent health, looking into truth of life, I think I just want to make a quick summary and just leave it as that, in that, you know, I think first of all, I think our interpretation of health is quite subjective. Following that, beauty is quite subjective as well. And I've sort of gone on to talk a bit about how we broke down the process of looking at our body with the help of modern understanding of our body, that we are actually not in true control of our body and, to a certain extent, our mind. And then with that, how do we deal with that is, first of all, with the noble truth to understand the truth that the body is, in fact, impermanent, and yet we suffer because we tend to cling on to a permanent self, so that when it changes, we feel upset, right? And so, how do we go about dealing with that? Really, it's about practicing more to free our to have the right understanding and be unafflicted in our mind, as what the Buddha has mentioned in one of the suttas with this elderly dying old man. And we could achieve that by really practicing the same things, the core teachings of the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Paths, and continuing to understand that. And I guess the thing is, you know, understanding the impermanence and the components of our body really breaks down barriers between you, me, person next door. So then there really is no need for, you know, discrimination, bias, these sort of things. But also understanding that because the body is impermanent, that, you know, we should ideally treasure the time, be grateful, and have gratitude towards ourselves, our family, our loved ones, and take every opportunity to practice the Buddhist teaching. And by practice, you know, it may not always be that you need to sit down cross-legged and practice meditation. I mean, that still is an important part of practice, but every moment of practicing, of going towards non-self, letting go of ego, things like that, is still helpful. So an act of generosity, a bit of monetary donation, giving up your time to help your friend who is struggling with his subjects, things like that. I think all work towards bit less attachment and bit more happiness. Yeah. So with that, I sort of finish what I want to say formally, and I welcome any further questions, whether they be Dharma or hopefully not general medical things. Yeah.
No questions?
Nope. Right. So, thank you very much for the talk, and I hope everyone learned a lot from it. So now I'll be introducing our next week event. So we have our English Dharma talk, like always. It's going to be on the final sermon of the Buddha, the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. What did the Buddha leave behind? That's going to be given by Jim Till. And same time, same place, my contact details are on the board, or you can contact me directly right here. We also have Chinese Dharma talk, which is the topic is on the cycle of life and death, or the cycle of... Whoops!
Well, it's still a circle.
Technically, you can still draw the circle. But, you know, cycle of life and death, samsara, that. And it's going to be given by Venerable Nengrong. And the time and place is 6 to 8 p.m. at Square House 207. And you can contact CC at the back. And her contact details are also on the board. We have our weekly sports session, and this week's Frisbee. It's going to be at the Village Green UNSW, so very nearby. So if you just walk out at the main walkway, you see like a large green field of, you know, where the grass are. 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. And just bring water bottle and towel, and you can contact Marco. Marco, please raise your hand. Marco. Yep. And we also have our weekly afternoon meditation session on Tuesday and Wednesday. Universe Library, 12 to 1 p.m. on Tuesday and Wednesday, as I just said. And you can contact Rico over there. Yep, his contact details are also on the board. And we have a very special event coming up, and that's Visa Day. So I'd like to invite Katie, I don't think Tommy's here, to come up and talk about Visa Day. Yay!
Okay, thanks, Tas. So hi guys, for those that don't know me, I am Katie, and I am one of your co-organizers for Vesak Day, which is coming up soon. So first of all, what is Vesak Day?
Don't know.
So why do we celebrate Vesak Day? Vesak Day is basically a commemoration of the life, enlightenment, and the passing away of the Buddha. So it's a very auspicious day for us Buddhists, and that's why we're going to celebrate it with you guys. And so what are we going to be doing on this day? So every year, Univards alternate between celebrating this day in the Mahayana and Theravada tradition. And this year, we'll be celebrating it according to the Mahayana tradition. So we'll be doing some chanting, and also we'll have Dharma talks given by our patron, Chao Kun Samai, and also our chapter, sorry guys, and also our chapter Venerable. So they will be giving Dharma talks. And also one very important ceremony is the bathing of the Buddha. So why do we do that? Has anyone ever done that before?
No.
So the bathing of the Buddha ceremony is symbolic of the purification of our mind, and that's why we do it. Also, it's fun. So this event is happening on Saturday, next Saturday, not tomorrow, and that's the 20th of May, and it will be at Law 203, and the time is from 2 to 5 p.m., and if you have any questions, do contact me right here, or Tommy, who is not here. So anyone have any questions, burning questions about Vesak Day?
But we have to bring.
So we don't bring anything, bring yourselves. And just in terms of clothing, just dress like how you would go if you were going to a monastery. So sleeves, shorts, pants, skirts over the knee. Yeah? Okay. Any other questions? Okay, I'll see you there.
Yay. Any more questions regarding events in general? No. Okay. May I please invite everyone to pay respect to the Triple Gem?
please parents pledge to adopt the meme though.